This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In a presidential election year like no other in most people's memories, we're going to take some time this hour to see this race through the eyes of a woman who has covered politics for ABC News and NPR. Cokie Roberts is a political commentator and appears, as most of you know, every week on NPR's Morning Edition to shed insight on contemporary politics. But she is also the author of a number of fascinating books about the influence of women on the early days of this country. She's been on this program in the past to talk about the founding mothers and ladies of liberty, and now she has turned her attention to the women of Civil War Washington. Capital Dames uncovers some never-before-told stories of women in a city at the epicenter of this country's most terrible conflict. Stories of their power and influence behind the scenes, strengthening the city, keeping lines of communication between North and South open, and helping to heal the nation after the conflict was over. And this hour, the woman the Library of Congress has named a living legend joins us from the Wells Fargo Auditorium in the Levine Center for the Arts to talk about history made and history being made. Cokie Roberts, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Mike. It's a treat to be here and a treat to be here with all these lovely people.
Yes, they're all WFAE listeners and donors, and we thank them on the radio publicly for their support. Thank you all for being here. Most of us are at least casual observers of politics and the political scene, and I don't think, well, let me ask you, are we exaggerating that this is the most unusual political season ever?
No. No, it is quite remarkable, and we are now going to go into an election where if either side wins, we'll be making history. We have never elected a woman president, and we have never elected a president who did not serve either in the government or as a general.
Never? Really?
No, never. I mean, think about it. Ulysses S. Grant and Dwight Eisenhower are the only people who have not been in government. And so I don't think Donald Trump is either of them. But I think that we're making history either way.
Wow. Another interesting thing about this election is that both of the front runners, Donald Trump, and at this stage of the game, he will probably be the nominee unless something wild happens tomorrow, and it could, and Hillary Clinton.
By the way, we were talking about this earlier. We in the world of journalism are so upset that there's not going to be a contested convention.
Yes.
I mean, shoot, it looked like it was finally going to happen, you know. For years, people say, oh, this is going to be a brokered convention, which, of course, couldn't exist because there are no brokers. But, you know, a contested convention really looked like it was going to happen. And we were really geared up for it. First, a rules committee fight, arcane stuff. I love arcane stuff. Bring it on. And then we were going to have, you know, fights on the floor. It was all looking so good.
Yeah. Could there be a third party convention?
No. There could be a third party run, I think. There could be somebody who, and it would probably be, you know, from the somebody who presents him or herself as a true conservative running, saying that Trump is not, which is what you hear from a lot of conservatives. And that could happen, but I certainly can't imagine there'd be a convention.
Who would that be? I mean,
I don't know.
If the Republican hierarchy, or anybody for that matter, decided we have to take a run at this.
It's not going to be the Republican hierarchy. It's not going to be people who are in the party structure or who hold office. They're going to get behind Trump for the most part and say, you know, let's make sure he wins and that he doesn't lose the House and Senate. It would be somebody out of the, I don't know, the intellectual wing of the party, the George Wills, the Bill Kristols, the Charles Krauthammers, the people who are saying that Trump is not a true conservative, and they have spent their lives promoting the conservative movement, and they would look for somebody to run as somebody they would consider
would
a true conservative.
Would any of the candidates who have run to date as a Republican be an option for them?
I don't think so.
Really?
No, I don't think that, because the person who in some ways is a true conservative out of that group is Ted Cruz, and there's a reason he lost, you know, which is...
And that reason is?
Nobody likes him.
You know, John Boehner, the former Speaker of the House, said, I think, 2 weeks
John
ago...
John Boehner unleashed, isn't it wonderful? I mean, just...
He said 2 weeks ago that he's the most miserable son of a you-know-what that he'd ever worked with.
And Lucifer in the flesh.
Lucifer in the flesh. I have never heard anybody say that, but it is reminiscent of things that were said by and to politicians throughout our history.
True.
Are we going backwards?
Well, they're not shooting each other, and they used to shoot each other all the time. Burr Hamilton was just the most famous of those duels. But they would call, the term of art was to call each other out on the floor of the House of Representatives, and they would go to Bladensburg, right outside of Washington, where there was a dueling ground, and shoot each other, over what they said on the floor of the House. And by the way, Burr Hamilton, think of it, Aaron Burr was the sitting vice president of the United States when he murdered his political enemy over political speech. Our most recent vice president had a problem with a gun, but it was... And the other night at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which I don't go to because I basically think I'd rather eat glass. But the but thankfully now they record it, and so we know what the president said, and he's very good at these things. And he was praising Joe Biden. And he says, you know, he's a great vice president. He's a good friend, and he hasn't shot anybody in the face. And so. You know, so that is, they're not shooting each other. So they haven't gone totally backwards.
Yeah, Aaron Burr just wanted to fulfill his dream of being in a Broadway musical, I guess.
Don't get me started on Alexander Hamilton.
Okay. I haven't seen it yet. Have you seen it? You got a ticket?
No, but okay. I hate him.
Okay. He's on the 20.
No, he's on the 10.
On the 10, all right.
And we were promised a woman would be on the front of the 10.
Right.
And because of a popular musical, the philandering liar Alexander Hamilton is staying on the front of the 10. And they're putting a bunch of little teeny weeny women on the back. Not good. That's
Well... Getting back to something you said a second, about Ted Cruz not being popular, all of the people in the race, and there were 150 people in the Republican race, all of them have dropped by the wayside, and I guess it could be argued that's because the voters didn't like them or didn't know them. Same is true of the Democratic side, and now we have Trump and Hillary Clinton, the presumptive nominees in both parties, and they are... the most unpopular candidates two parties have ever fielded. How do you explain that?
Well, of course, we don't know for sure that that's true because we didn't do polling on favorables and unfavorables in history. I don't think Millard Fillmore was all that popular, but we are in a period where voters are very unhappy. And they're unhappy with politicians for good reasons in many cases. But so the voters who are very unhappy with politicians have produced Donald Trump as the Republican nominee, but the American people as a whole right now, and this is not something that's necessarily going to hold, but right now say they don't like him. And he might be able to change that. And he might be able to convince people that at least if they don't like him, they like her less. But Hillary Clinton has been around for a very long time. She does say, and she's right about this, that when she's not running, people do like her. And it is true that her approval ratings, when she's serving as First Lady or in the Senate or as Secretary of State, are positive. It's when she's running for office that she gets into the negative territory.
You're a keen observer of political people and politics and have been your entire life, and you grew up in a political family. So when you look at Hillary Clinton, is it something that she does or doesn't do while on the campaign trail that just rubs people the wrong way? Or is it that she's part of the Clinton administration
it's
of the 90s?
The above.
Really, it's all of the above.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is that, you know, on the campaign trail, she is, I mean, normally when you see her on television, what you've seen is her at a rally. And so she's revving people up and all that, but it has the effect of making her seem like she's shouting and unpleasant.
Would we notice it if she were a man?
Not as much, certainly not. Certainly not. I mean, there's no question that running as a woman is very different from running as a man.
Hmm.
I mean, the whole conversation about your hair and your weight and your all of that. I mean, do any of these men look great?
Well, you're in tell.
I'm just saying.
And you're in television, and you know that women on television are criticized by viewers for the stupidest things you can imagine. They could be reading the Gettysburg Address, and all people would notice is that their lipstick doesn't match their necklace.
Well, I hope not. It's true, but so then you just learn to live with that.
Right.
And, you know, it's a visual medium, and people are going to be noticing what they see. And I think, you know, Hillary Clinton tries to deal with that as best she can, but it is something that's just going to be different for a woman than a man.
Reince Priebus, who's the chairman of the RNC, the Republican National Committee, said that it was time now for Republicans to get behind Donald Trump and support the candidate. Do you think they will?
I think by and large they will. I think that the elected Republicans, the people whose greatest interest is winning, will get behind him because they think that that's the way for the party to win, and they don't want to be out of the White House for another 8 years. They also are very worried about retaining the House and Senate. And so I do think that the party, the elected people in the party and the people who want to win the election will get behind him. As I said earlier, I think the people who are committed to the conservative movement will not.
But if he's legitimately frightening to them because of some of the things he said in his campaign speeches, why would they want him to win the election? Are they Republicans or patriots?
Oh, that's not fair, I don't think. I think that, you know, they would say that there's no difference between being a Republican and a patriot. I don't think they think that he would be terrible for the country. Hmm. I think that there's also a whole idea that it's all an act. You know, his own guy that he hired, Paul Manafort, that he hired to help him wrangle convention delegates, essentially said that. He said he's been playing a part up till now. And now that once he gets the nomination, he doesn't have to play that part anymore. And he has said that. He keeps saying, you know, I had 17 to start with. I only have two more to knock off. As soon as I knock them off, I'll be so presidential, I'll bore you to death. And he kind of does this imitation walk of a president, which is kind of odd. But I think that there is among a lot of Republicans a sense that this is not the guy, that he's done this to win the primaries, and he's not going to do it to once he's got the nomination.
We'll follow up on that when we come back.
Support for this special edition of Charlotte Talks come from WFAE members and Birdhouse on the Greenway, celebrating Mother's Day with nature-inspired gifts, butterfly gardens, and bird feeders, reconnecting people with nature. BirdhouseOnTheGreenway.com. Tomorrow on the Charlotte Talks Weekly News Roundup, the U.S. Department of Justice says that the bathroom parts of HB2 violate federal law. We'll talk about what it means and what they're telling the state to do about it. Charlotte is thinking about raising property taxes by 1%. City leaders went to Denver to look at that city's mass transportation system. We'll learn what they took away from that experience. Donald Trump appears to be the GOP nominee, what that may mean for North Carolina candidates. Those stories and much more on the Charlotte Talks Weekly News Roundup tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, new research shows medical error is the third leading cause of death in the U.S., killing more than 250,000 people a year. Why there are so many mistakes and what can be done to improve patient safety.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
Coming to you from the Wells Fargo Auditorium at the Levine Center for the Arts, it's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. Our guest today is the very funny Cokie Roberts. I never knew you were this funny. Cokie Roberts from NPR and ABC News and the author of several books, the latest of which is called Capital Dames of the Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868, which we will get to before this program is over. We were talking about Donald Trump and how he says he's been playing a part. Have you met Donald Trump?
Yes, I have.
What do you think? Is he playing a part?
Well, it's hard to know. I did interview him several years ago when he was talking about running for president then, and I recently found a picture of us together where he wrote in great big metallic gold magic marker, "Thanks, Cokie, you're the best." I don't think he thinks that now. But what I don't think is that he has thought through policy positions. And so what he does is he comes up with something and sees whether it works or not. And what's worked in these primaries is to say, we should ban Muslims from the country. And in the exit polls from the Republican nomination process, two-thirds of the people coming out of the polls have said, yes, we should ban Muslims from the country. He says we should build a wall and Mexico will pay for it. And more than half of the people coming out of the voting booth say, yes, we should build a wall. So what he is saying is absolutely appealing to the electorate in the primaries this cycle. And whether he has any idea how to put policies together to do that, or whether that's even something that he would do, we have no way of knowing. That's a great big chance to take.
That's where the frightening part of this comes in, I think, because it's almost as though, this is pure speculation, that he did that reality show for so long, and they shoot hours and hours and hours of tape. So he's shooting off the hip, and what ends up in the show are just the little choice nuggets. It's almost as though he's shooting from the hip live and thinking that the nuggets will come out of this.
Happens is if it doesn't work, he stops it. It's very interesting. I mean, it is very much like somebody trying out a show.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't work in New Haven, you know, he doesn't take it to Broadway, and that is very much if you watch through the season, if he tries something and it doesn't have an effect, he drops it, but then he goes back to what is the tried and true, and the tried and true has been the basis of his success: two things, anti-immigrant and anti-trade, and those two things he has repeated and repeated and repeated, and those are the two things that have really spurred on his success. And, of course, his whole affect, the fact that he is, that he is a celebrity, and that, and people think that maybe he can shake things up and get things done. And the other thing that voters say they love about him is that he tells it like it is. Because they're so sick of politicians, you know, having been media trained within an inch of their lives, that they are tired of hearing all that slick stuff.
Yeah.
And so those are the things that people say are appealing. But what that means in terms of policy, we have absolutely no idea.
There are a lot of people who are voting in these primaries and who voted in the last two elections who are just really tired of government as it is and establishment politicians. That's partly how Barack Obama got to the White House, at least the first time. It's why Bernie Sanders is so remarkably popular on the Democratic side.
Do you love that? I mean, Bernie Sanders is your basic get off the lawn guy. And I mean, and all these 20-year-old girls are swooning over him. I mean, it's just, you guys have a future.
Somebody said that he combs his hair with a balloon. But anyway, think about it. A lot of people are unhappy with politics as usual and with what's happening in Washington, but isn't that their fault? Isn't this exactly what they asked for? When the Tea Partiers came in, they voted Tea Partiers in to stop what was going on. They were successful. They stopped everything.
Well, I think there's been a certain amount of overpromising, though, because the Tea Partiers also said, you know, they were going to repeal Obamacare, and I think there was a sense that they would change Washington as we know it. The problem with that is, of course, you can't do that because there's something called the Constitution. And the founders really meant for that not to be possible. And so they, you know, the last revolution that was successful was in 1776. And that was for a reason, that the founders wrote into that remarkable document that has served us so incredibly well for 225 years, that the process could not be overturned, that one person or one party can't do it, that it has to be a considered, you know, compromised situation. And so anybody that promises to go in and say they're going to get all these things done is bound to be thwarted, and then the voters who think that person's going to do it are very disappointed. Right.
Do you think part of the problem is, A, the primary system, B, the fact that we are an instant gratification society now, when we weren't in 1776? We waited for everything.
And we didn't.
Pardon me?
Even I wasn't covering things in 1776.
It was in all the papers. You read it. But we want it now, and we don't see why it can't change. And is part of the problem also that we're not teaching civics.
Well, we should certainly do a much better job of teaching civics and history. And my hat's off to the fabulous history teachers. I know a couple are here who are really trying to do that. And it's not easy. School systems have not put a high priority on teaching of history, and they haven't put it on the teaching of government and civics. So it's something that communities need to be much more involved in getting the schools to do.
And how much of it is a problem that we generate? Because media tends to cover the horse race.
True.
Media has not talked a lot about how Donald Trump really hasn't outlined a lot of his policy and proposals. He hasn't done any.
We do both. I mean, what happens is that there are always big takeouts on policy or a whole series, you know, on Morning Edition or All Things Considered, on what are the candidates saying about energy? What are the candidates saying about education? What are the all of those things. By the time the campaign, people actually start paying attention to the campaign, however, it's by that time you are into the horse race, and that's what people start to pay attention to. And of course, in this primary season, we've had such a race, there have been so many people in it, that the horse race was the story.
Yeah, well, that's true. And it's gone on for a year, because really it's gone on for a year.
Right.
You have, and we've talked a little bit about this, but you have expressed fears about a Trump presidency, and you expressed those fears in a recent column in which you called for the rational wing of the Republican Party to stop Donald Trump's march toward its presidential nomination. Too few words, too late?
Well, I think that that's been true for everybody. I think the Republican establishment, such as it is, thought that he would flame out. And they really did not get it together to start to oppose him until way too late. So these whole Stop Trump movements and all of that, which have spent tens of millions of dollars trying to stop him, were just too late for that. And also there was nobody for them to get behind. If there were an alternative candidate that they could have promoted. That would have been one thing. But that's where the Ted Cruz problem comes back in.
Right.
And by the time it all got organized, you were really kind of down to Ted Cruz and John Kasich and Donald Trump.
That column got you into a little...
Tiff
with NPR. The network was struggling to remind people that you don't function there as a news person, you function there as a commentator, and that the network would, and I quote here, work with you to refine the contours of your job. Why do you think NPR listeners don't understand the role of a commentator?
Well, my basic reaction was NPR listeners have been listening to me for 40 years. I have been in situations like this where I've met with people, you know, individually as well as in large groups, and I've written a variety of books, and I've been asked about everything from potty training to, you know, politeness lessons to, yes, politics. And I think NPR listeners pretty well know who I am.
So the contours of your job... How have they been refined? I love that phrase.
I have no idea.
And as a part of NPR's response to that, you had an on-air conversation with Morning Edition host David Greene, in which he asked, "Objectivity is so fundamental to what we do. Can you blame people like me for being a little disappointed to hear you come out and take a personal position on something like this in a campaign?" Was he speaking for himself when he said people like me? Surely he's not that naive. Or was he speaking for the network when he said that?
Well, he said people like me. I take it to mean him.
Did that surprise you?
It was a difficult weekend where people were all bent out of shape, and David was put in a tough role. My answer to this question was, you shouldn't be disappointed. I'm in a completely different role than you are. You know, yeah. His role is to be the straight, head-on host. My role is to be the commentator. Now, my commentary tends to be without much personal point of view, because I think it's more useful to tell people, you know, the balance of both sides, because I see it so clearly and have seen it for such a very, very long time. I think the Donald Trump situation was a different situation, and that I was at an age and stage where it was somewhat incumbent upon me to say that.
Well, you're not alone. In the May 2nd issue of New York Magazine, Andrew Sullivan, who is a conservative, writes about Plato's Republic and the portion of that where Plato writes about democracy being the best breeding ground for tyranny. In it, Plato describes a democracy where inequality comes under intense threat, where multiculturalism and sexual freedom creates a country like a many-colored cloak decorated in all hues, where the authority of elites fades with establishment values ceding to popular ones, where the very rich come under attack, where patriarchy is dismantled, where in classrooms the teacher is frightened of the pupils and students make light of the teachers. And Plato argues, and he didn't like...
Plato said all of that?
Yes, well, in his own words.
He said multiculturalism?
Yes, I'm sure that that's... I'm sure that's,
you know,
Andrew Sullivan's
there
take.
There wasn't a lot of that going on in ancient Greece. I mean,
no, there wasn't.
I remember we lived in Greece for a while and covered a Greek election. And Steve, my husband, says to the guy, you know, well, what's the ethnic vote breakdown? The guy looks at Steve and says, the Greeks voted for Karamanlis.
I'm sure that was Andrew's liberal translation from the original Greek. Plato was no fan of democracy, evidently. He argues that atmosphere is one in which a would-be tyrant will often seize his moment. Plato says this would-be tyrant is usually one of the elite, but in tune with the times, and who makes his move by taking over a particularly obedient mob and attacking his wealthy peers as corrupt. And eventually, he promises to cut through the paralysis of democratic incoherence. This sounds very familiar.
Well, look, the voters have chosen Donald Trump on the Republican side. It's not that he went in and took over power and staged a coup. The voters have chosen him. Now, you can say it was just a plurality of voters in the initial states, but by now he's up to 50-some percent, 60 percent, and he is the legitimate choice of the voters of the Republican Party. What the country as a whole now decides to do is another question, but he is not an illegitimate choice.
Should we be concerned at all? For any reason, that a non-politician could be the next president of the United States?
Yes, I think it's concerning, partly because I think government is complicated. And having some understanding of how it functions is important. And one of the biggest problems we've had is that people are unwilling to go through the difficult day-to-day work of putting together legislation and compromising to make it work. And that's what you have to do. But I think much more concerning about Donald Trump is the hate speech. You know, look, I grew up, as many of you did, in the Jim Crow South. You know, I know how hard these last 50 years have been. I had a cross burned on my lawn because my parents were for civil rights. I mean, I know the effort that has gone into trying to bring this country together. And somebody trying to make it go into shatters and have us be against each other, whether it's because we're of Mexican extraction or of the Muslim faith, I think is not American. And I think that it is flying in the face of all of the incredible goodwill and effort that has taken place over the last half century.
Well, that took a lot of time off the clock. So we're going to have to take a break, I think. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the election. But we're also going to spend time talking about this book, which is remarkable, as your other books have been, because there's a lot of new information that we never knew about people we never heard of. In this case, the women of Washington in the Civil War era, 1848 to 1868. We'll do that when we come back from the Wells Fargo Auditorium with Cokie Roberts on Charlotte Talks.
We'll be back with more of our special conversation with Cokie Roberts on Charlotte Talks here on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE. Support for this special edition of Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte-Mecklenburg Stormwater Services, providing volunteer opportunities for residents to improve neighborhood streams through the Adopt-A-Stream and Storm Drain Marking Programs. Info at stormwater.charmec.org. Coming up next at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, guest host Derek McGinty is in for Diane. He'll talk with experts for an analysis of the news about John Kasich bowing out of the presidential race. Donald Trump becomes the apparent GOP nominee after John Kasich bows out of the race. We'll have a conversation about that in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, here on 90.7 WFAE.
Manufacturing can be profitable and messy, toxically messy.
They have clearly prioritized business interests over securing the health and safety of these communities, which is their mission.
I'm Kai Rizdal, paying up to clean things up next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Cokie Roberts. And we're coming to you in front of an auditorium full of people at the Wells Fargo Auditorium at the Living Center for the Arts. You have done a lot of looking back in your career as an author of books, in, looking back particularly to people who were involved in the early days, the founding of the country, and not the men.
The men have had a lot written about them.
Yes, they do. You've written three books about people who've made considerable contributions against considerable odds, and they are the people left out of the history books. You're a woman. Obviously, that's why it interests you. How difficult is it to do the research, though?
It's very difficult. It's essentially detective work, particularly for the founding era. When I was working on founding mothers, stuff just wasn't there, with the exception of Abigail Adams' remarkable letters, of which there are literally thousands. But other than that, it was really going around and finding a little bit here, a little bit there. Some of it was the fact that, you know, there was a certain cultural difference between me as a daily journalist and the people who were the custodians of manuscript divisions and historical societies. I'd call and say, you know, you've got the papers of Nathaniel Green. Do you have the papers of Catherine Littlefield Green? And they'd say, well, we've really just scratched the surface of Nathaniel Green's papers. How would we know? And I'm saying, it's been 200 years. So that was a problem. But actually, after I wrote Founding Mothers, and people started to see that there really was a wealth of interest and information about the women, when I wrote the sequel, Ladies of Liberty, I got a lot more cooperation.
Yeah.
And so people started looking for women's papers, and that was very helpful. And now with Capital Dames, first of all, it's later in history, so that helps somewhat. But it's also true that technology is my friend, because if people do find letters, for instance, there's a fabulous character in this book, Virginia Clay Clopton, whose husband was a senator from Alabama, and his papers, but that's what happens, it's his papers, but the women's papers are often with them, are at Duke. And my wonderful daughter-in-law went to Duke and found that Virginia Clay had a diary, which hadn't been published. And so the people there, the lovely people in the manuscript division, then can scan the diary and send it to me. So that's a huge difference.
Yeah.
The other big difference, and you will appreciate this, Mike, is newspapers now are all online. And from the late 18th century on, and it is fabulous. I mean, you can waste days reading these newspapers, because first of all, you're reading what they were reading in real time, and you're reading about them in real time, but also all the ads are there, so you have a much more complete picture of the society.
Sure.
And so it's a lot of fun, it really is. So the information is, that information is much more accessible, and also, much to my surprise, the women of the Civil War era were in the newspapers. And, you know, that really surprised me, because when I was growing up, a proper lady was only supposed to be in the newspaper when she was born, married, and died. And these women were in the newspapers all the time.
Under what circumstances?
Well, they had parties that were very influential in terms of Washington politics, and so they were talked about there. And then after the war, when they came and tried to get paroles for people, that was all covered. When the Southern women came back to Washington, their returns were covered. And then when they all became these purposeful, interesting people running social service organizations and becoming suffragists and such things, that was all covered. And Verena Davis, the wife of Jefferson Davis, who turns out to be an utterly delightful person, Him, not so much. But she befriended Julia Grant. And that was page one news in every newspaper in the country. The former First Lady of the Confederacy meets with the wife of the general who defeated the Confederacy. And that was covered everywhere.
She had a tough life.
She did have a tough life, but that was mainly because of him.
Well, yes. We had his great-grandson.
Oh, I know him, Bertram.
Yeah. On this program, and one of the things I learned that I didn't know was that Jefferson Davis had at one time said slavery could not last. It simply would, the weight of it would cause it to crumble eventually, and was trying to find ways to end it, even as he was the president of the Confederacy.
It's so heartbreaking, really, and I really never expected to write about the Civil War. Mainly for this reason, it breaks your heart, and it somewhat gets back to the conversation about today, because I do believe in the system, and I do believe that the founders had it right, but these politicians could not get it together to get to emancipation without killing 600,000 Americans, and it's such an indictment. And you know, when it was all over, the women basically said, you know, men can't do this with justice and mercy. It requires women in government.
Interesting.
Yeah. Of course, the other reason I would never wanted to write about the Civil War is all of my ancestors fought on the losing side. And in the middle of all of the Civil War controversy, the Confederate flag controversy and everything, a cousin of mine who lives in Wilmington, who I had never met, sent me our mutual great-great-uncle's Civil War uniform. So it's now in my closet. It fits.
These women that you write about, some of them were famous, some of them were important because their husbands were important, some of them not so. We think of women going to work in World War II. We think of Rosie the Riveter.
Right.
But the same thing happened in the Civil War.
Right, that's what
I never knew that.
I mean, that's really what the book is how the war changed the lives of women, and very similarly to World War II. And for Rosie the Riveter, there were women who came. These were very poor women and usually quite young, who worked in the arsenals. And in Washington, there was a horrible arsenal explosion, and 20-some women were killed. And and here's where the newspapers are so interesting. The next day, the reporter's there, and they pull off the tarp, and there are these charred, unrecognizable bodies, and he says they were trapped in their hoop skirts. Mm. And so it's July in Washington. They're doing incredibly dangerous work, but dressing like proper mid-19th century women. And the next day, the president and the secretary of war led a procession of thousands and thousands of people to Congressional Cemetery for their burial, to honor their contribution to the war effort.
Hmm. Verena Davis, let's get back to her for a second.
She's
the
great.
wife of Jefferson Davis, and she was the second wife of Jefferson Davis.
But his first wife was only for like 15 minutes.
Right. But evidently he had very strict ways about him, and she was under his thumb for a good part of the time until something happened that changed his mind, and he allowed her to come to Washington, where she became almost the belle of the Congress. She had a stool set aside for her on the floor of the House or the Senate, where she could go and sit with the senators, and she watched the great debate over the Compromise of 1850 on the floor of the Senate.
Well,
would that be allowed today?
That. No, it would not be allowed today. They actually, there was a good bit of the women going onto the floor for major debates until at one point the vice president, it turned out to have two ladies of the street on either side of him, and that became something of a little scandal. But the women were deeply interested. They were very political, and they did watch, and they were engaged in it. And actually, there's one letter that I found so telling, and I don't even know the author. It was written, it was quoted in a book by a Virginia woman named Sarah Agnes Pryor, whose husband had been in the Congress and a newspaper man, and he had been a very hot-headed Confederate who had really sort of ginned up Sumter, and then the war ended, and she ended up in they ended up in New York, and she became quite a noted writer. But she had saved her letters from when she was quite in terrible poverty during the war. He was in prison, and she was with six kids and, you know, having nothing to eat and all of that. And she got a letter from this friend from who was in Richmond saying, it was right after the bread riot, because, of course, the South was in terrible shape. And in Richmond, the poor people had nothing to eat, and the women rioted. And this friend saw these emaciated, furious women, and she was so upset. And she said, these are the people who are suffering from all of those debates we went to and watched in the House and Senate as they were talking about extending slavery into the territories. And these are the people who have been affected by it. And I don't know who to blame. I know it's not you nor I, but it is awful. And so it was so interesting because they had sort of seen those debates as an intellectual exercise in a political theater, and then here were the dire, dire effects.
And it was a time when it was a very difficult time to compromise, particularly on the one issue of slavery. And today we're in another time where it's almost impossible to compromise on any issue, big or small. When you look back at that time and you read these letters and you read the newspaper accounts of things that went on in the House and Senate and around Washington at the time, are there lots of parallels
yes,
in your mind?
Yes, and it's very upsetting. The one thing that it is, you know, that is in our favor is that there is not an overarching, enormous moral issue. And slavery, of course, was
Have
that.
You heard of HB2?
It's been mentioned.
So in that case, the parallels would stop because there's no slavery in our time to fight and die over, because it was not only moral, it was an economic issue at the time.
But, you know, we're not talking about owning human beings.
Right. You describe in the book something I've never seen before, never read before, and I'm a Civil War buff, and that is the exit from the Congress of the Southern senators and representatives and the speeches they made as they exited and the tears that flowed as they made those speeches. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, see, that's what's also... And Jefferson Davis is interesting in this context because he also... You know, was one of the key architects of the expansion of the Capitol when he was Secretary of War and the building of the dome, which was the great symbol of unity. And so as he gives his speech to walk out, you know, there's just enormous upset on his part and on the part of all of his peers. And the women were all there, too. And, you know, a great deal of weeping and understanding that they were doing something that they couldn't come back from, and that they were breaking faith with the founders. And it was something that was, they understood what they were doing was quite dramatic and foreboding of terrible things to come. I don't think they realized how terrible they were to come. Verena Davis did. She wrote to her mother when she got to Richmond and basically said, you know, we can't win this thing. We don't have the manufacturing and we don't have the railroads. You'd think the men might have noticed. But she said, you know, but I'll play my part.
Mm. Interesting comment about the men not noticing, because you also say in reading through these hundreds of letters and diaries that you read through in preparation for this book, that the women's letters are so much better than the men's. Why?
Because they're real. The men's letters, the men, you know, considered themselves very important men. And they would write their letters with the expectation that they might be published. And so they would write them and they would edit them and they were generally just about weighty issues. And then they were often quite pompous. And that would be the correspondence that they expected to show up in a book someday. Whereas the women just wrote letters, and they didn't expect anybody to keep them. They didn't expect anybody to read them other than the recipient. And so they were frank and funny, and they did talk about politics, absolutely, because they were very political. But they also talked about fashion, and they talked about the economy and who was having and all too often losing babies. And so you get a much franker and fuller picture of American society. But they also, let me just say this, Verena Davis, for instance, they just tell the truth. So she wrote a letter to her mother. She was furious that Adele Cutts, who was this beautiful, brilliant young woman in Washington who was Dolly Madison's great niece, and Verena was furious that Adele was about to marry Stephen Douglas, the senator from Illinois who defeated Lincoln and, you know, the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And she writes to her mother and she says this, you know, brilliant young woman is being handed off to the dirty trickster and party speculator, broken in drink, with his first wife's money, gets this woman because she's poor and her father's proud. But then she says, it's a good thing that there's a new water system coming to Washington so Douglas may wash a little oftener. So we don't learn from the men that Stephen Douglas stinks.
That and more in Cokie Roberts' latest book called Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868. We're not a letter-writing society, so 125 years from now, the next Cokie Roberts will have to get all of her information from Hillary's emails, I'm afraid. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you, Mike. Delightful to be with you.
Charlotte,